Well, tonight we continue our series on historical theology and church history. We tonight are going to look at the Jewish background. So in the first century AD, the time of the early church, the time of Christ and the apostles, what was the Jewish background? Last time we looked at number one in this outline, in this section here of the Roman Empire and its background. And we looked at how it came to be that there was a Roman emperor, as well as the common things that brought everyone together, not just the Roman emperor himself, but their economy and trade, and their Hellenistic culture. And we know that that was because of Alexander the Great, his short conquest, 336 BC to 323 BC, but it left behind Greek language, Greek literature, Greek education, art, and philosophy. And as we looked at, there was Greek religion, and that was the official religion of the Roman Empire, was the traditional pagan mythology of the Greeks. We saw that there was also emperor worship, that was characteristic of the Greeks, to see their rulers as a demigod. And there were certain mystery cults, Eastern mystery cults, that were also a part of the Roman Empire. We saw in that intellectual climate of the philosophy of Middle Platonism, Epicureanism, and Stoicism, the three top schools that Nick Needham, the historian, summarizes, and we're using his volumes as the primary source for this series. He titled his volumes 2,000 Years of Christ's Power. So the idea is that Christ is building his church, and he's still building it right now. So what we're studying in church history eventually then is Christ building his church. But at the moment, we're just looking at the background. So it's not only important for us to know the background of the Roman Empire, but the background of the Jewish people themselves. For at the time that Jesus lived and the apostles lived in the early church in the first century. So that's what we're looking at tonight, the Jewish background. And I had mentioned last time we met that we will begin with when the Romans first got contact with the Jews. It was in 161 BC that the Romans first came into contact with Jews, and it was for a military alliance. After Alexander the Great died, you know, he had conquered vast territories. He had gone through the Baltics. He had gone through Asia Minor and Syria. He had gone through east toward what is present-day Iran and Iraq, as well as Palestine and into Egypt, and left Hellenistic culture in the whole area. But what arose after Alexander the Great's death was various empires. And to the east of Palestine, to the east of Israel, the Seleucid Empire was there at the time. And the Seleucid Empire posed a threat to the Roman Empire. So the Romans, being quite smart, signed a military alliance with Israel, and that Israel would use their military to help protect each other against the Seleucid Empire to the east. It's going to become important later, as I'll point out, but keep that in your back pocket, okay? That this military alliance, there's in a sense a mutual friendship at the beginning here. And then The Roman Empire in 88 BC began a war in Asia Minor against King Mithridates IV. That war lasted 22 years, from 88 BC to 66 BC, where the Roman Empire is trying to conquer Asia Minor against the king that's there. And they won that war with the Roman general Pompey the Great. Pompey the Great was born 106 BC and died 48 BC. So he was a contemporary of Julius Caesar, the greatest statesman and general of the Roman Empire. And you remember Julius Caesar was born 102 BC and was assassinated 44 BC. So they were two military leaders prominent in Rome when it was going through all its civil wars. But in addition, it's going through civil wars itself, and then it's also attacking other areas. That whole 100 years before Christ was filled with civil wars and massive fighting and killing, which, as we said, which was very important then for the rise of Caesar Augustus, the nephew and adopted son of Julius Caesar, who, you remember, reigned for 45 years, and brought peace, really, and order to that whole Mediterranean. But he, you remember, defeated all of the senators and all his enemies in 31 BC, and they named him Augustus the Exalted One in 27 BC. But from 31 BC to 14 AD, then he reigned for 45 years as the Emperor of Rome. Now, when this war for Asia Minor, that 22-year war, ended in 66 BC, under the leadership, military leadership of Pompey the Great, at the same time, a civil war began in Israel between two brothers, Hyrcanus and Aristobulus. Hyrcanus and Aristobulus. Two brothers in Israel vying for power. Both of these brothers appealed to Pompey the Great, this general, for help. Pompey entered Jerusalem in 63 BC and confirmed, you have to pick one or the other, he confirmed Hyrcanus instead of Aristobulus. He confirmed Hyrcanus as the high priest in Israel and as the political ruler, but not as king, not as monarch. Instead, a Roman governor of Syria, which is north of Israel, was placed over Israel, was placed over Judea. This is where Rome wants some control over that area. In other words, they came in, and in exchange for helping and confirming Hyrcanus, they say, okay, you can be over religion. He's the high priest. You can be over the religion in Israel, and we'll let you be a political ruler there, but not the monarch. We're going to have our own person, a Roman governor that's been over Syria, be over Judea. 6 years later, so that was 63 BC, where Pompey entered Jerusalem and set this up. Well, 6 years later, Aristobulus' son, Alexander, not too happy. Pompey picked Hyrcanus, not Alexander's dad, Aristobulus. Well, so then in 57 BC, Aristobulus' son, Alexander, he raised a rebellion against Rome, which Rome crushed. Rome crushed the rebellion and left Hyrcanus only as high priest of Israel, removed him of having political rulership. So in other words, the result of the rebellion is that less control is taking place in Israel by Hyrcanus, an Israelite. And Rome is, in response, crushed the rebellion and is taking more control. Now there's further rebellions and wars. And Augustus, we know, rising as the Roman emperor, that occurred. Julius Caesar, assassinated 44 BC, in the 13 years from 44 BC to 31 BC, Octavius, Julius Caesar's nephew and adopted son, Octavius Caesar, defeated all of the senators and his enemies and became the emperor in 31 BC. And then the Senate, the Roman Senate, filled with followers of him, gave him the title Augustus in 27 BC. What the Romans did, though, after further rebellions and wars and Augustus rising to power in that period of time, they placed Herod Antipater, which we know as Herod the Great, on the throne in Jerusalem and Judea. They made a Roman province. So you get further rebellion and further rebellion, and Rome responds by crushing the rebellion, bringing order, crushing the rebellion, bringing order, but also taking more control. Now, Herod Antipater, as we know, is Herod the Great. This is the Herod, because there's several of them, and you can get confused with it. It's easy to get confused with it. Herod Antipater is the Herod in Matthew chapter 2 that sought to kill Jesus as a little boy. And we know that's where, based on the timing of the Magi, the wise men from the east, when they saw the star as he sought to kill the boys 2 years old and under. The son of Herod the Great is Herod Antipas. So when Herod the Great died, he had three sons, and that's where Judea was divided up among his three sons, which showed as well that Herod Antipater was quite a skilled ruler. He was ruthless, too. He had some of his own family members killed. But his sons were not up to his level of keeping law and order. And that's why it had to be divided up in thirds. Well, it was his son Herod Antipas that got over the Galilee, the northern area. He's the one that killed John the Baptist. Okay? Herod the Great's son. Herod Antipas. He did. And that's where they usually say 4 BC, remember, because the dates. That's where they think Christ was born, because remember, around 500 AD, we have this Sicilian monk. And remember, he comes up with the dates. He looks at when Rome was founded by tradition in 753 BC. We looked at that last week. And then he figured up, so then Christ was born. So then he's the one that came up with BC and AD. He counted down from when Rome was founded in 753 BC, but he was about 4 years off. And that's where they have Herod the Great being roughly 38 BC to 4 BC, if Christ is born somewhere around 4 BC. That's where there's approximations on that. They're not exactly sure, yes. But some will say 37 BC to 4 BC, but for Herod the Great. But that's where we think Christ was born in zero, and everything BC and before it, and everything AD after. But the date, actually, we talked about it last week, but might be about 4 years off. So he did pretty good, around 500 AD. But eventually, over time, as we said, then it was adopted as the main calendar of history. Herod the Great's son, Herod Antipas, that killed John the Baptist, he was over that kind of northern part of Galilee in Israel until the emperor Caligula deposed him and exiled him in 39 AD. Now, I mentioned earlier, to keep in your back pocket, how their relationship began between Rome and Israel. So the Romans first came into contact with the Jews in 161 BC with a military alliance. It benefited both of them. So because of their past alliance with Rome, this is where Israel was going to help against the Seleucid Empire to the east and help defend one another. Well, because of their past alliance, the Jews enjoyed many privileges, and this is where that stems from. To be exempt from military service was a privilege that they enjoyed in the Roman Empire, as well as they did not have to take part in pagan rituals, not even emperor worship. Going into the first century AD, that's the privileges they enjoyed because of that early military alliance. Now, remember here, at the very beginning, we had these two brothers. Pompey the Great picks one of the brothers, so the other brother's son, 6 years later, he raises a rebellion Rome has to quench. There's other further rebellions and wars. Well, in 6 AD, we have Judas the Galilean mentioned in Acts 5:37. He led a Jewish rebellion against Rome. We have another rebellion against Rome, which Rome won, and Emperor Augustus placed Judea, the region of Palestine, under the direct rule of a Roman governor at that point. So after every rebellion, they take more and more direct control in response to saying, well, these people are just rebellious. We have got to put the hammer down on them to keep law and order. And that's what was happening. So Emperor Augustus placed Judea, that region, under the direct rule of a Roman governor, a procurator who was answerable directly to the emperor. No more messing around here. Emperor Augustus said, I want somebody in charge there who answers to me, because these people keep rebelling. Pontius Pilate was one of these governors, as you know, procurators over Judea, directly accountable to the Roman emperor. And he governed during Jesus' public earthly ministry. Pontius Pilate governed from 26 AD to 36 AD, for 10 years. During Jesus' public earthly ministry, the three-year earthly ministry. So he governed, controlling three things: military and public order, taxation, as well as administering justice. Those were the three main functions of the governor of Judea on behalf of the Roman Empire. With military and public order in Caesarea, or near the coast, they had an army post. So the Roman army was posted there in Caesarea. So if they needed for public order to have the Roman troops come in, taxation. So the Roman governor is responsible for collecting taxes on behalf of the Roman Empire in this area, in Judea. The income tax was 30 to 40%, which in our progressive income tax system today, that's in the high tax rates. And most people in low middle class with tax credits and everything pay nothing in our system. Get more back in tax credits than anything that's taken out and withheld. But in ours, the lowest is around 10-12% in the progressive federal income tax rates we have. But theirs was 30 to 40%. And they had a poll tax. A poll tax, what's that? That's an equal tax on everyone. And this is one of the reasons why we think when the census was declared by Caesar Augustus, and everyone went to their home city, of why we think Joseph took his pregnant wife Mary with. Why, being pregnant, why would she go with? Well, it could be a poll tax. And she may have went with because of the poll tax. It's a tax on everyone being an individual in the Roman Empire. Sometimes it was the census was for military drafts, but we know that they were exempt from part of their privileges. They were exempt from military service. so it wasn't for that. Yeah, that's right. The Israelites, like Matthew, the tax collectors, before he was converted and saved, they work on behalf of the Roman Empire. They were considered traitors, and they collected the taxes for Rome, and many of them kept extra for themselves. So the governor, again, oversaw the military, which there was an army post in Caesarea, maintained public order, and taxation the governor oversaw with assistance from tax gatherers locally, right? But, and then third, the administration of justice. The governor could pardon at will, or the governor could sentence to death at will, which we see as well with Jesus, with Barabbas. And Pilate knew Jesus had done nothing wrong, but he wanted to maintain public order, and he was answerable directly to the emperor. If that wouldn't focus your thoughts for public order. But think of that, though, at will. So presidents, the U.S. presidents under our constitutional system can pardon for certain reasons and grant pardons. But the governor here, the Roman governor over Judea, could also kill at will. But again, this was all the response because of continuous rebellion by the Israelites. And so I'll just say this as a side note, when you're pondering all of this, you better win. Or the greater power will totally stamp out your liberties. So within this control by the Roman governor over Judea, over Israel, the Jews did still have some degree of local independence. So they did have courts of justice throughout the land. They had synagogues spread out across the land. So they still had courts of justice that the Jews oversaw their own system of punishing crime within their own society. In addition, the Sanhedrin was allowed to function and exist. It was the supreme governing council of the Jews. It had 70 members. So we know it had its own police force. The Jewish aristocracy, so the wealthy of the Jewish society, were members, and they were mainly priests, lawyers, and elders. Priests, lawyers, and elders. Think of it like the Supreme Court of Israel at the time. And they could try all legal cases. So Rome's in control. They have their governor directly responsible to the Roman emperor, and yet they're allowing this province of Judea that Rome claims as its own, they're allowing the local people, the Jews, to administer their own justice according to their own laws. There's four main groups or parties of Jewish religious life at that time. Four main groups or parties of Jewish religious life. So the time of Jesus Christ, the time of the apostles, and there were four main groups or parties of Jewish religious life. I put them as A, B, C, and D. A is the Sadducees. They were centered on Jerusalem and the temple. Almost all of the Sadducees were priests. So when you think of the money changers and the animals qualified to be without blemish and how they could charge exorbitant prices and all of that, they were involved in that. Almost all of these were priests of the Sadducees, members of the Jewish aristocracy, the wealthy. They were the strongest group in the Sanhedrin, the Sadducees. In the Sanhedrin itself, this group was the strongest of the 70 members. So who held sway, the greatest sway, among the Supreme Court, the Sanhedrin, the 70-member council of Israel? And it was the Sadducees. Now, interestingly, they accepted the authority of the Pentateuch alone. The first five books of the Bible, written by Moses. And they were what's called the subtractors. They believed in no life after death, so no bodily resurrection, no life after death, and they denied the existence of both angels and spirits. We know that based on Matthew chapter 22, verse 23, and Acts chapter 23, verse 8. So again, they only accepted the authority of the first five books of the Old Testament, the Pentateuch. And they did not believe in a bodily resurrection from the dead. This life is it. Didn't believe in spirits or angels. Epicureans were that way. If you remember, we looked at last week. But there's several in that perspective, right? It's kind of a secularism mentality. Okay, the second group is the Pharisees. These, if you say, well, which group of the four had the greatest influence over ordinary people? And it was the Pharisees. So the Sadducees, they were the strongest group in the Sanhedrin, the ruling body in Israel, the 70-member ruling body. But among ordinary people, it was the Pharisees that had the greatest influence. Which you could see then why, when the multitudes were following Jesus, it made them the most mad, jealous. That's their power base. The largest group emerging after Israel's exile in Babylon, around 500 BC, is when they emerged. If you remember, Babylon was taking the southern Judah and Benjamin, the southern two kingdoms, into captivity in waves around 600 BC. So in the 500s, they were in 70 years of captivity. And then Cyrus, king of Persia, defeated Babylon, and then he, by God's prophecy and sovereignty, permitted the Israelites to start going back to the promised land. But they started the synagogue system when they were in exile. And the Pharisees emerged after Israel's exile in Babylon. So don't think that they were there, this religious group, since Moses or anything like that. Pharisees means the separated ones or the pure ones. Literally what it means. The separated ones or the pure ones. So they have a high moral code and a lot of man-made rules. A high moral code and man-made rules. You know, and Jesus in Matthew chapter 23 talks about gnats and camels. Remember, they neglected the weightier things, but he said, these you should have done without neglecting the other. So the small things is very important, but they neglected the core issues. But they're very detailed, right? Focusing on gnats and other things, which is important. But we must never neglect the core truths and morals of God's Word. And then they added, and which is a tendency. When people are very concerned about ethics and morality, what do they tend to do? Go overboard, right? It's a human tendency. Tend to add things. Well, then all of a sudden we start saying, you know, women's skirts can only be so many inches, right? And then you become legalistic. Start adding rules. But you're concerned with modesty, right? It's important. But then what's the tendency then is to keep going overboard. Some of the English Puritans did some of that. Banned Christmas trees. Did a few other things. They had a tendency to be a little puritanical. They believed the Roman Empire's victory over Israel was God's punishment for Israel's sins. That's what the Pharisees believed. God has authority over all things. He's the judge of heaven and earth, and he judges nations in this world. Just because they're a Pharisee doesn't mean that they're wrong on everything. Right? Just like I can study the ancient Greek philosophers and find some things that are true. Thales of Miletus, the founder of Western philosophy, predicted when an astronomical event would take place. Accurately. He's a good scientist. Just because he's an ancient Greek philosopher doesn't mean he's wrong on everything. But the same with the Pharisees. And I think they're right. The Roman Empire's victory over Israel was God's punishment for Israel's sin. Wouldn't shock me. But you go with the rebellion after rebellion after rebellion, and you read Romans 13, 1 through 10, that he who resists the authority resists God. Civil resistance is taking up arms. That is different than civil disobedience. It's better to obey God than men. So I'll obey God if they command me to do what God forbids or forbid me to do what God commands. I'll disobey. But civil resistance is actually taking up arms. It's rebellion. And what we had there was one after another after another. So the Pharisees believed the Roman Empire's victory over Israel was God's punishment for Israel's sins, and the Pharisees accepted the whole of the Old Testament, contrary to the Sadducees. The Pharisees accepted the whole of the Old Testament, as we do, and the reality of the spiritual world, as we do, the reality of angels, and the reality of the human spirit. And they believed in a bodily resurrection, which we do as well. So in the Apostle Paul, who was Saul and had been a Pharisee, got converted, Acts chapter 9, he's one who knew the whole of the Old Testament quite well, to go to all the Old Testament prophecies of Christ and then to start reasoning from the Scriptures. Okay, so we have the Sadducees, the Pharisees, the Zealots is the third group at this time, during the time of Christ and the Apostles. Zealots. The zealous ones, literally, zealous ones. You could say these are a party of terrorists or freedom fighters. That's the way Nick Needham defines them. A party of terrorists or freedom fighters. They want freedom from Roman tyranny at all costs, at whatever means. The zealots thought it was sinful to pay taxes to the Roman Empire. Remember, we talked about the income tax and the poll tax. And remember, the official religion of the Roman Empire is pagan. The mythical gods and goddesses of ancient Greece. So your income taxes are supporting the religious festivals and ceremonies of the pagan gods and goddesses. But Jesus, remember, said, whose inscription's on the coin? Give unto Caesar the things that are Caesar's, and unto God the things that are God. They're accountable for what they do with that money. And yet we have every right to say, according to the word of God, they should be condemned for their paganism. God's people are the conscience of the nation, right? But the question is, what do you do about it? And the zealots often acted as assassins. They're assassins. Trump had one in Pennsylvania. An assassin tries to kill someone. So that's what these were. They were trying to murder Roman officials. One of Jesus' 12 apostles, Simon the Canaanite, was or had been a zealot. Luke 6:15. It's good to have zeal, but it must be directed according to the word of God. And you think of these groups. So we've had the Sadducees, the Pharisees, the Zealots, and now the fourth is the Essenes. You say, okay, this is a situation where they're under the tyranny of the Roman Empire, the control of the Roman Empire. They're allowed some independence underneath it, but it's high taxation. What do you do about it? Well, the Zealots were like, we're going to take it into our own hands and start murdering Roman officials and act like terrorists. Well, the Essenes were like, well, let's separate and form monasteries in effect. Our own little outposts of communes, of communal living. So the Essenes, they broke away from ordinary life and lived together in small communities. Said, well, we're going to go out on our own away from all this mess. One prominent theologian and historian who was a Jew, Philo of Alexandria. Alexandria, you remember, is on the coast of Mediterranean Sea in the southeast in Egypt, the city of Alexandria. Okay? So Philo of this city of Alexandria. Philo of Alexandria, he was born in 20 BC, died 45 AD. He's a contemporary of Jesus. The apostles. He was a Jewish theologian and historian, and he estimated that there were about 4,000 Essenes in Israel at the time. Now, they practiced several things. They practiced celibacy. They didn't marry. They refused to swear oaths. They had frequent washings for cleansing. And they studied the Old Testament regularly. So they had some unique views, right? And they're living in communes, so they don't really believe much either about private property, really. You think about it that way, too. So they practiced celibacy, refused to swear oaths, frequent washings, and studied the Old Testament regularly. Interestingly, they studied the Old Testament regularly. They took care of their manuscripts. In one of the remains of their communities was found in 1947. I think it was from 1947 to 1956 was where they kept excavating these documents. But the Dead Sea Scrolls, one of the communities, Qumran, near the Dead Sea, had certain texts from the Old Testament. Some of the texts were their own sectarian writings of the Essenes. Some of the writings are in Hebrew, Aramaic, and Greek. There was quite a bit that was found in that one community of the Dead Sea Scrolls, which also gave further evidence to the accuracy of the documents we have of the Old Testament. Okay, so those are the four groups: the Sadducees, the Pharisees, the Zealots, as well as the Essenes. Now, if I asked you and said, where were the majority of Jews living at that time, the time of Jesus and the apostles, where were most of the Jews living? In Palestine or outside of Palestine? And the answer, most were living outside of Palestine, called the diaspora. It's the Greek word for dispersion. That most Jews, it refers to them, they're the diaspora, those who have been dispersed and scattered about, particularly around the Roman Empire. Most Jews did not live in Palestine, but were scattered throughout the Roman Empire, and there were large numbers in certain cities. Alexandria, as I said, is on the coast of the Mediterranean Sea, southeast corner in Egypt. Antioch, as well, is near the Mediterranean Sea, but it's northwest side of Syria. Syria is north of Palestine. Ephesus is a city in Asia Minor, near the coast as well. Aegean Sea, northeast Mediterranean, and as well as Rome in Italy, west of Greece. These cities had large populations of Jews living there, of the diaspora. In the cities, they tended to live together in separate areas, which we've seen that with immigrants in our own cities over the years in the history of the United States. What's unique in Wilmer with the Corinne is they've spread out, right? Own homes all over in Wilmer, and it's pretty neat to blend in. And yeah, that's an answer to prayer, yeah. The Jews, though, tended to live in separate areas of a city and would not eat with the Gentiles. Because of their strict dietary laws, made it hard to eat with the Gentiles. So they typically would not eat with Gentiles to make sure they didn't eat anything unclean. So for the Gentiles, from their perspective, the Jews seemed antisocial. Say, what was the perspective of the Gentiles at that time out in those cities of dealing with the diaspora, the Jews that had been dispersed? The perception was the Jews were antisocial. That was the perception of the Gentiles. Now, what's interesting is to say, okay, were some Jews tempted to become more like the Greeks? The answer is yes. And were some Greeks likely to be converted to Judaism? The answer is yes. And that's what this last two sections are dealing with here. Some Jews, especially in Alexandria, sought to blend their Judaism with Hellenistic culture. And the greatest of these was Philo. Philo of Alexandria, who died in 45 AD. This theologian and historian that's a Jew. And he's the greatest example of someone who was a Jew who sought to blend their Judaism with Hellenistic culture and interpreted the Jewish faith in light of Greek philosophy. Philo combined the Old Testament idea of God's Word with the Greek philosophical idea of reason. The Greek word logos can mean reason or word. For many Greeks, reason was divine. You remember last week we talked about one of the philosophical groups, one of the philosophical schools that was dominant at that time, the time of Christ and the apostles, and it was Stoicism. And you remember among the Stoics, they believed that there was a supreme power. So among the Greeks, remember, they don't have a creator-creature distinction. They don't. But among the realm of existence, there's this power, a part of it, that is supreme. So there's different powers. And the Stoics believed in a supreme power that controls all things. Almost like a field of force loop. Okay? And the name they gave, you remember, they gave different words, the Stoics. God, fate, providence, or reason. There's four terms the Stoics used for that power. And they believed, remember this, in Stoicism, they believed that the human soul has a little bit of that power. And the key to a life of fulfillment is aligning ourselves with that power. Many of the most virtuous Romans were Stoics. As well, many early Christians, as I said last week from Nick Needham, many of the early Christians enjoyed reading the Stoics because it had similar ways of thinking as a Christian. But this is where you can see then where we know that God is the supreme power. He has reason. He thinks. He's a mind. Well, Philo never mentioned Jesus of Nazareth in his writings. So we know he did not truly understand the Logos, the true Logos of God. From John chapter 1, verses 1 through 3, verse 14. In the beginning was the Logos, and the Logos was with God, and the Logos was God. And verse 14, the Logos became flesh and dwelt among us, and we beheld his glory, glory as of the only begotten of the Father, full of grace and truth. So that's where some, reading his writings, Philo of Alexandria, say, well, maybe he was a Christian, and say, there's no evidence of that, sadly. Much more common were Gentile converts to Judaism, and they were called God-fearers. You could look that up, Acts 10, verse 2 and 22, Acts 13, 43, and Acts 17, verse 4 and 17. So Gentile converts to Judaism were called God-fearers. Gentiles were attracted to a belief in one God. They're coming out of this traditional pagan religion where, again, it's all chaotic. Among the gods and goddesses marrying, having wars and fighting among one another, committing infidelities, and each into their own little area. Demeter over the harvest, Dionysus over celebration, Poseidon, Neptune over the sea, right? They all have their own little realm that they're over. The goddess Athena is over the wisdom of warfare. Ares is over the horrors of warfare, so that's his domain. They all have their own little domain. And again, that's why I said in American Western Civ class at Greek mythology, when you read some scholars on ancient Greek mythology, they have the patron goddess of this and the patron god of that. It's like the Roman Catholics are the patron saint of whatever. And then they would pray to them. If you want blessing in one area of that domain where that god or goddess was, then you'd pray for that. But there's nothing unifying anything. And every time, and there's times where the gods and goddesses are fighting one another in their own epic poetry of Homer, Hesiod, and later the Roman poet Virgil. What you can see is a Gentile convert, you're looking at it and you say, well, I'm attracted to the idea that there is a personal God, one God, who created it all, the supreme reason of all things. He's personal and he's infinite. And that is unique to Christianity, to Judaism and Christianity, Judeo-Christian religion. That the true and living God is both personal and infinite. For the Romans, as well as the ancient Greeks, their traditional pagan religion of the gods and goddesses, where the gods and goddesses were personal, but they were finite. Finite, not infinite. And they were not the creator of all things. So the Gentiles were attracted to a belief in one God who's both personal and infinite, and they were attracted to a pure moral code. A pure moral code for all life. You do not have that among the mythology of Rome and ancient Greece. You have infidelities, you have betrayals, you have lies, among all of their gods and goddesses. Not a good situation. You even find that some of the gods and goddesses are homosexual. And blending of animal and human characteristics and all sorts of craziness. Okay, because it's all of this kind of the Greek monism and oneism, that there's just this eternal stream of organic life, chaotic. And out of that came certain gods and goddesses over certain areas, but it's all chaotic. No order, really. Irrational. So the Gentiles were drawn to Christianity, the Judeo-Christian, especially Judaism here, with one God, infinite and personal, and the pure moral code of Judaism summarized in the Ten Commandments. But Gentiles were put off by circumcision. What adult male would want to walk in and say, okay, I'll be circumcised? They were put off by that. So they typically would refuse circumcision. So I'm not going to do it. But they attached themselves to a synagogue. That's what was typical. They were God-fearers. They believed in the living and true God of the Bible, creator of all, personal and infinite, and the pure moral code of the Bible, summarized in the Ten Commandments, but they did not want to be circumcised. So the Jews then still looked at the uncircumcised God-fearers as pagans. Placed great weight, the Jews did, on circumcision. The most obvious example of a God-fearer that we have in Scripture is the Roman centurion Cornelius in Acts chapter 10. The Apostle Peter goes and preaches Cornelius and his household. Now we're going to end this section with this before we move in the next time we meet to the next part of history here. Rome is facing threats all the time. Roman Empire. It's a big empire. And the various other empires around it here and there attack them. And in the ancient city of Babylon, at that time, there was the Parthian Empire that controlled it. So because a large community of Jews were in the Parthian city of Babylon at that time, it made the Roman Empire nervous. Because the Parthian Empire was a constant threat to them from the east. A lot of Jews, we have these Jews who have had this constant rebellion against us. One of their religious groups, the Zealots, were assassins, killers, and will not submit to Roman authority. And we have a whole contingent of Jews living in the city of Babylon under the Parthian Empire. Makes us nervous. Okay? the growing tensions between the Roman Empire and the Jews in Judea would finally explode into the Great Jewish War from 66 AD to 73 AD. You remember the temple was utterly destroyed in 70 AD. But that's what this is all moving toward then, is the Great Jewish War from 66 AD to 73 AD. So when you think of church history, it's a story, right? History. It's a story of the facts of history. But it all involves historical theology and ideas. And we're going to see how they play out over time. And we saw that with Middle Platonism. We talked about that last week with Middle Platonism and how Christian converts that came out of that philosophy of Middle Platonism that was the most dominant philosophy at the time in the first century, many of them viewed the body as something less than the soul and therefore swayed into Gnosticism. Not good. And many of them had trouble accepting the deity of Christ because of that Platonism background, which eventually was dealt with the Arian controversy at the Council of Nicaea in 325. But this is where we'll see certain ideas play out too in historical theology over time. Okay, so Lord willing, next time we meet, that's where we'll pick up in the story of church history.